check, check. That's a little noisier, yeah. So let's start all over again. So everything I talk about today is going to be motivated by real-world experience as a consultant. And basically we're trying to figure out how to make the world approach to security change so that developers and architects and people who are building our systems do a better job building them in the first place. That's what software security is about. That's what security engineering is about. You know, for many, many years from the beginning of computer security, the whole idea was we've got the broken stuff and we have the bad people, and we're going to put a thing between the broken stuff and the bad people. What's that thing called? Anybody know? You can talk. It's okay. What's the thing called? Oh, good. Somebody said it. A firewall. Right. So the real question is, why is the stuff broken anyway? We want to build stuff that's properly constructed so that it's harder to attack. And that's kind of a new paradigm in computer security, something that it's catching on, but we have a long way to go. And that's what I do every day at Cigital. This is the structure of the talk today. This is a talk that I put together originally to give at Dartmouth. That was the first time. And since then, it's been delivered to both academic audiences and audiences in Washington. So I actually gave this very talk that you're going to get at DARPA for the program managers and all, and the director and all those peoples at the Department of Defense. And most recently, the weirdest one was at the Naval Intelligence Lab in Washington, and I went through all this security. I walked into the room, and 400 people went, "Foomp!" And I got to tell you guys, I'd way rather talk to students than 400 people at attention. So that was an odd thing. The work originated with a guy named Nate Fick, who was the CEO of a think tank called the Center for New American Security. And we did this work together because the policymakers in Washington don't understand computer security very well at all, and they're making poor decisions, from my perspective, around policy because they don't understand the way computer security really works. And so I worked together with Nate, and we wrote a paper about this stuff, which became this talk, but this is all joint thinking that was done with Nate. So the first thing is that when you talk about cyber and you say cybersecurity, that's sort of a new term that's like promulgating planet Earth, and it's a meaningless term. What does cyber mean? Nobody really knows. What is cybersecurity? Well, whatever the politicians think it is today. Right? So what's the difference between computer security and cybersecurity? Who knows? And so one of the issues in Washington is that there's a lot of hype around things like cybersecurity and cyber war, and there's a bunch of talk that just doesn't make any sense. So the first thing you got to do is try to separate out the hype from reality, because if policymakers are thinking the wrong sort of stuff, then they're going to make silly sorts of policies. And the biggest challenge, I suppose, in cyber whatever is disentangling cyber espionage, cyber crime, and cyber war. And when you go and you talk to policymakers, they'll often trot out an example and they'll say, well, this is a cybersecurity problem, so it's cyber war. And you say, no, that's actually espionage, or that's actually crime, or whatever. If you separate them out, it makes for a much more rational discussion. Because, look, cyber crime is pretty huge. There's a lot of cyber crime going on. It's not enough to poke up, you know, to make us have a radical change to the world, but there's a fair amount of cyber crime. Cyber espionage, a little bit more rare. The Snowden revelations make us realize it's less rare than we thought. But it's not as common as cyber crime, which happens to people on the street, on the internet all the time. Cyber war, extremely rare, right? So we need to separate out all those three things, so that when we're thinking about cyber war, we're only thinking about the rare thing, not thinking about cyber crime and mixing it all together. One of the tricks that politicians do is to get it all confused so that it seems like a much bigger problem than it really is, and we can get people excited and motivated to change things. So that's number one, is to separate those things out. The good news is, from a perspective of security engineering and building stuff right, it doesn't matter if we're talking about war or espionage or crime. if we begin to build systems properly, we can kill all three of those birds with one stone, so to speak. That is, if we build systems that are secure, cyber crime will be harder. If we build systems to be secure, cyber espionage will be harder. And if we build systems that are secure, cyber war will have to have a different look and feel than it has today. So the good news is, even if we're just working on this notion of security engineering, we're going to make progress on it all. When it comes to cyber war, though, there are some hilarious hype stories. Probably the one that you hear the most often in Congress in the United States is this Estonia DDoS attack, where Estonia was apparently like taken off the net by the Russian hacker boys or whoever when they decided to remove a Russian statue from some park or whatever. We sort of wonder about that. But you know, taking Estonia off the net turns out to be not so hard. Because Estonia isn't all that connected to the internet, and their pipe is really little. And so DDoSing a little pipe is a pretty straightforward operation, right? In fact, if you think about the same attack carried out against, I don't know, Google or Amazon, do you suppose that we could take down Google with the same attack that took down Estonia? What do you think? Probably not. You know, they'd be like, oh, look, a little tiny ant is trying to attack my foot. You know, so they would notice, but it would be sort of a trivial exercise. So there are people in Congress who say, they took down an entire country off the internet with a DDoS attack. And you go, yeah, but okay, never mind. So that's one piece of hype. There's some stories that didn't actually really happen, like this fake Brazilian blackout. But my favorite one is when the Chinese hijacked the whole internet. And basically what they did is screwed up BGP management. Right? BGP is so badly designed that you can do a zone transfer for all of China or whatever. And they recently did another BGP problem that aimed all Chinese firewall traffic at some woman's house in Iowa, which was absolutely hilarious. That was a DDoS attack that took Iowa off the net, but there you go. So the real question is, does that sort of stuff count as war? Not really. You know, DDoS stuff is not really war. In fact, we tried to figure out what would war be, cyber war. And so Nate and I said, well, let's just look at the war literature and read our von Clausewitz and all that stuff. And we decided that war should be something that has a kinetic impact that's very clear. So somebody dies, something blows up, a physical problem occurs. They say war goes kinetic. That means we're flinging metal at other people or exploding stuff or whatever. And so that's what we're using as our definition of war. And by the way, just to set some more context, Nate was a Marine captain, and he was one of the people at the pointy edge of the Iraq invasion. The second one. So that's kind of he's a real war guy. I'm not a war guy. I'm not a war fighter, but Nate is. And so it was interesting to have the perspective of a person who'd actually been in a real war with real people and brought them all home without getting any of his guys killed, which is pretty cool. And talk about what war really means. It changes the way you think about cyber war when you think about real war. And there's some people who throw around cyber war as if it's not real war, which is a disturbing and awful thing, right? And so I think we have to be much more careful with our definition. So if you say it has to have a kinetic impact, then we have a few stories of some real cyber war stuff. Probably the first one is a gas pipeline that exploded in the Soviet Union that involved basically the Soviet Union was building a pipeline, and they took some Canadian technology and they re-implemented it. They stole some Canadian tech. But people knew that that was going to happen, and so there were certain things put into the Canadian tech that caused the pipeline to fail in such a way that it was a massive, massive explosion that you could see from space. That was kind of interesting, and it was all caused by, you know, software that was intentionally placed to do that. That was a long time ago. 2007, the Syrians were building a reactor. The North Koreans were building a reactor in Syria, and Israel went in and blew it up. Of course, Syria said, we didn't have a reactor, nothing blew up. So it was kind of an interesting thing. But apparently, the Syria's air defense system was off while the Israeli F-16s flew in and blew the thing up. So they were able to take their entire air defense system down and then go in and blow some stuff up. And that really happened. In 2008, when Georgia was invaded by Russia, they did an invasion with tanks and guys and, you know, burned some people's buildings and killed some people. And they also did a cyber attack at the same time against the Georgian banking system and brought their communication systems down. That probably counts as cyber war, too, although it was jointly done in a kinetic action. So, you know, we're talking about places and situations where something blows up or somebody dies or it's a permanent thing. And then probably the one that got cyber war on the map in the United States was a paper written by William Lynn, who was the Undersecretary of Defense, I think, at the time. And he talked about an issue with an infection that happened in Iraq and a USB stick infection thing, which didn't result in much other than, you know, some compromise of information. So we don't really, that one doesn't really count. But the reason it's worth mentioning is because that's the first time the military establishment in the United States said, you know, this cyber stuff really actually impacted our war planning and had a negative impact, and we need to think about this and build our systems in a new way. And then the last one is Stuxnet. So I want to talk about Stuxnet because it's a very interesting case, and it's a case where we went after, we being, I guess, the U.S. and the Israelis, went after the Iranian nuclear program, but we didn't really go after it to blow stuff up, per se. It's a little bit tricky, but we certainly did have a direct kinetic impact on the Iranian nuclear program. So we'll talk about that next. One of the issues with all of this cyber war, cyber defense, cyber offense stuff is that the entire discourse is deeply impacted by the national security people in the U.S., especially the spies. And we have a problem with this in the U.S. We accidentally put the same people in charge of offense and spying as we did in charge of defense. And if you think about it, this poor guy, Keith Alexander, who's going to be the head of the NSA for another couple weeks, General Alexander has two jobs to do. One job is to spy on everybody. And you know what? There's nothing wrong with spying. Everybody does spying. Everybody uses all sorts of methods to spy. I'm okay with spying. It has its place. I'm glad the NSA is really good at spying. It sucks when they break the rules and they spy on U.S. citizens. But you know what? They're supposed to spy on Norwegians. Sorry. That's just how it goes. And your spies are supposed to spy on us, so get over it, right? But the deal is this. The same guys that are doing the spying are making use of the fact that everybody carries a cell phone in their pocket. And I don't even know where I put my cell phone. It must be over there. Everybody has one of those in your pocket, which is a little spy device. You have a computer that has a video camera that may or may not be on. You know, according to Yahoo, it's on a lot. And according to the Snowden documentation, it's on a lot, and it's really bothersome. There's stuff you shouldn't do in front of your video camera, by the way. So these guys are using the fact that we designed those systems to just function without thinking about security or privacy when we designed them to spy. And it's incredibly useful to do that. And then we asked the same guy, General Alexander, hey, can you spy on all those foreign countries out there and especially our enemies, which you're not? And, you know, and at the same time, can you defend us from cyber attack? Now, if you're supposed to spy on stuff, it's really useful to have a whole pile of broken tech out there in the world because you can take advantage of all of those vulnerabilities to get your spying job done. But if you're also tasked with defending the stuff and building it right and making sure that you can't do that, well, which job is most important? What do you think? You're putting someone in an impossible situation right there. That is a policy mistake. And it's an important policy mistake that Washington is just coming to grapple with. And in fact, if you think about the end of World War II, when nuclear technology had been deployed, and we had a nuclear arms race going on, there were some very smart people in the United States who set up the policy situation so that all of the nuclear power could not be concentrated into less than 1,000 people in the United States. And the idea was, we're going to have the people that build and test weapons, nuclear weapons, in the Department of Energy. And they're going to be different from the people who blow people up with the weapons or deploy them. That's the Department of Defense. And those two sets of people are not the same, so you don't put the power to build and deploy weapons in the hands of just a few human beings who could make very bad decisions. That was a brilliant policy move that was done after the end of World War II. We need to make the same policy move when it comes to cyber stuff today, because we've put all of the power in the hands of the people who are building weaponry and are thinking about deploying weaponry instead of real defense. So I want to talk about what that means. The first problem is that defense in cybersecurity is a tricky proposition. And if you ask most people in computer security, well, what do you think cyber defense is about? They'll talk about operations. They'll talk about, you know, security operations center, stuff, network defense, system administration, watching attacks in real time, blah, blah, blah. That to me is not real defense. That's just watching, right? So watching and operations and system administration to me don't count as real defense. Real defense for me means building stuff properly in the first place. So we want to defend ourselves by making our stuff way less susceptible to attack. And that's a pretty big difference. You know, when you say, when I say to the U.S. government, we don't do much in cyber defense, they say, well, you know, we've got those operations centers like the one in Winchester, Virginia, where we watch the internet and blah, blah, blah. And I say, well, what do? You just watch the attack? You know, oh, yeah, we can see the stuff unfolding in real time across the globe. So what do you do about it? We turn it off. I mean, really, it's very ridiculous. The answer needs to be that, you know, security is not about watching yourself being hacked. It's about stopping someone from being able to hack you in the first place. So that means building stuff properly. Offense, on the other hand, is just everything you would think, you know, exploiting vulnerabilities, finding things automatically, piling up 0 days, building weapons to deploy against your enemies. That's what cyber offense is. But the defense thing is very, very tricky, and we got to get that right. Let's talk about the problem with an overemphasis on offense. The first thing is very, very simple. We all live in glass houses. Our systems are riddled with security vulnerabilities. We built them without thinking about security because, you know, computer security 30 years ago when we were designing all this stuff was not that important, and it's become a lot more important. So we're sitting here in a highly vulnerable situation. When you think about who controls our power grid, who controls our communication systems, the way we set up all this stuff, we didn't set up our critical infrastructure to be secure in the first place, and that means we actually do have some vulnerability that we need to worry about. But if we focus only on offense, then what we're doing is piling up a really nice pile of rocks to throw in our glass house. And you all know that Grandma said, don't throw rocks if you live in a glass house. So when you go to the warfighters, say, hey, you guys are spending all of your energy figuring out how to do fast, more accurate rock throwing in cyber world, but we're all in this glass house. They go, oh, yeah, maybe we need to think about that a little bit. So an overemphasis on offense is a bad idea for many, many reasons. Panetta, by the way, is the Secretary of Defense in the United States, in case you don't know who that is. I put this quote on the board at DARPA, I guess it was last month, and after the talk, this guy came up and one quote is Panetta saying something really wrong. This is sort of halfway right, but the next quote is like utterly wrong. And he came up and he goes, hey, which one of those things that the Secretary said was utterly wrong? And I said, what was this one? He goes, well, I was his speechwriter, so I actually wrote that. So it's kind of cool. Maybe we'll have some sort of, you know, second order impact on these policymaker guys through their speechwriters. So That's one problem. The glass house rock problem is one problem. But the real problem is this. It's a problem of attribution. So who knows about The Hobbit in here? You got some geeky people? Of course. Everybody's read The Hobbit. Right? So I wrote this paper about the attribution problem, and I actually went back and reread parts of The Hobbit to make sure that I got the story right about the trolls. You know that story? So Bilbo is supposed to be the burglar, and he's out with the dwarves, and they come across some trolls, and he's supposed to steal their stuff. And, of course, he's a bumbling dingbat, so he gets caught immediately and put in a bag. And then all the dwarves get caught when they try to... And the trolls have them all in bags, and they're talking about how they're going to cook them and what that one little thing is and whether it would be good fried or, you know, put over the fire or whatever. And then Gandalf comes and starts throwing his voice so that the trolls begin to fight amongst themselves about, you know, various aspects of cooking dwarves and who they should eat first and blah, blah, blah. And he gets them in a big fight, and the sun comes up and they turn to stone. Everybody remember that scene? The problem is an attribution problem. The trolls think that they're arguing with their colleagues or whatever, their brothers, whatever they were, when actually somebody else is injecting, you know, misinformation into the system and causing them to have a fight. On the internet, the attribution problem has not been solved. So if you have a hair trigger offense situation where you say, if you attack us, we're taking all your stuff down immediately with all of our, you know, cyber horrible things. We're going to just wipe you off the internet. And you get some misinformation about who's attacking you and you can't tell who's really attacking you, you got a problem. You see, so one of the things that's happened in war for centuries is misinformation about who's attacking who. And if you can get your enemy to attack your other enemy, well, that's a very helpful thing when it comes to global geopolitics. And so, you know, in the cyber situation, if we set up with all these hair trigger offense stuff, and I don't know, the North Koreans make it seem like the Iranians are doing something to us, or maybe, who knows, there are many, many ways that this could go, we have a serious problem on our hands. Now, one of the things that I checked into before I gave this talk last at the Office of Naval Intelligence was to make sure that the attribution problem really hasn't been solved. Because those of us who work in non-classified, you know, cyber defense stuff, we all believe that. No academics believe that the attribution problem has been solved. You cannot tell who's who on the net. And so I actually went and talked to Bruce Schneier, who's read all the Snowden docs, and said, hey, is it still true that the attribution problem hasn't been solved even with all the NSA revelation stuff? He said, absolutely. It has not been solved. So even the classified stuff that we're all supposed to not know about that's slowly leaking out over the next 2 years is going to show that we still haven't solved the attribution problem. Now, one of the problems with this example, by the way, that's taken from the movie, is after very carefully going back and reading The Hobbit and writing this little story very carefully, it turns out that they changed the damn thing in the movie. So I went to see the movie and I was like, oh, all that work, and I was gonna get the, oh, never mind, right? So watch out, you know, those darn Hollywood guys will do whatever they feel like. Now I want to talk about what real cyber offense looks like, and I want to disavow you of the belief that it is something that's like so elite that nobody could do it, or so sophisticated that nobody could do it. And I want to do that with reference to Stuxnet. So the Stuxnet code was pretty interesting. You know, the idea was to go after the nuclear program in Iran, but we weren't going to try to just blow up their centrifuges. The idea was to make the engineers in Iran feel like they were incompetent nincompoops. More about that later. And you got to realize that in Iran, probably the worst thing to have to be is a nuclear engineer, because you have your government and the theocracy saying, you got to get this done, and you got the Israelis blowing up your cars and your family with sticky bombs, and you have the equipment that's at Natanz and in your centrifuges not working properly because of Stuxnet. You see, what happened was Stuxnet got into the system and made things just behave incorrectly. So you'd look at the console and you'd set it all up and you'd turn it on and it would do the wrong thing. It would produce the wrong kind of stuff. And you would go, God, we set it all up, let's do it again. And you would just, you know, it just never worked right. So you felt like you were an incompetent boob, plus your friend just got blown up, right? That kind of sucks. So, you know, although I got to tell you this, I really would rather not have a theocracy have a nuclear weapon, and we can argue whether the U.S. is a theocracy or not, but I don't think so. Right, so... So let's talk about Stuxnet. What happened with Stuxnet was this virus, you know, escaped the world, the worm escaped into the world, and it got noticed. And, of course, it got noticed by the usual suspects, McAfee, Symantec. They started doing their usual round of hype around a virus. They weren't clear on what it did, and there was a lot of talk in the press about the delivery mechanism. Ooh, it had 4 zero-days and stolen private keys and blah, blah, blah. And all the tech press covered all that stuff. They were wrong about some of it. There was really just 1 zero-day. But whatever. That's not the important part. The important part was not how you deliver the thing to the target, but rather what the thing does at the target, right? The payload was the important part. And these people that do analysis on normal Win32 platforms or whatever had no idea what this big half a megabyte glob of attack code might do. In fact, they couldn't even tell what it did or why it was there. It didn't even run. They didn't know. Until a German named Ralph Langner came along, and Ralph works in control system stuff and had for many years. And so he saw that code, and he was like, whoa, that looks like Siemens code to me. So he set up a little lab, and he put, you know, Wireshark on there, and he watched the packets go by, and he ran it as a Siemens control code, and sure enough, it was Siemens control code. It was Step 7 code, which... is part of Siemens Somatic PLC, that's a program language controller stuff. And the idea was to inject running code into the centrifuge system so that it, you know, had the wrong periodicity and it introduced some timing issues mostly. But it also hid itself. So it got in there and screwed things up, but whenever you said, hey, what's the setting for number 4, it would tell you not what the real setting was for number 4. It would just be off by a little bit. And it would also lie and say, everything looks fine here, while it was like making everything not fine. Right? So that's kind of what it was doing. Now, the real attack, if you got down underneath it, was something called DLL interpositioning, which is a classic attacker in the middle attack that we've known about since, oh, I don't know, 1997 or 1996, I think, was the first one. You know, back in the day, Microsoft had all these DLLs, and so you had a problem if you installed some new code, somebody drag along a new copy of a DLL or an old copy of a DLL and wipe out the one that you had on your box. So depending on what you installed last, you'd have a different DLL with the same name. We called it DLL Hell back in those days. And it was very hard to tell when you came onto a box what the library situation really was. So everybody brought their own copies of the library, wiped out everybody else's stuff, and you just installed. So for a while, you were good until somebody else came along and did the same thing to you, right? Now, DLL interpositioning is as simple as this. And in fact, it's something that we saw in exploiting online games in, you know, around 2006, 2004 maybe, 2004. So this is World of Warcraft, the way it works. So you see this this main thread is a thread that every once in a while, like 1,000 times a second, will run something called Render World, which just flushes the buffer and updates your screen. Pretty clear on that? So the way DLL interpositioning works is we put a Microsoft Detours patch, thanks Microsoft Research, right there on Render World, and we just put our own DLL in the system, and we call our injected DLL, and so we just have it do some stuff. For a while, we take control of the program. We change the state of the world, and we just send control back at the end of that. So we can have a little bit of control of the WoW process, and if you get that, you can do just about anything. That's why they invented the Warden, by the way, to stop that. That doesn't work anymore in World of Warcraft. In fact, it stopped working around 2006. That is the nature of the Stuxnet attack from, you know, whatever, just recently. So was it super mega ultra sophisticated? No, not really. I mean, the Iranians were running Windows XP crap, and, you know, they're running Siemens systems from the 70s, and, I mean, it's just, it's old stuff, and it's an old attack that actually works against that. Now, here's a new attack. This is to give you a contrast about the difference between what's going on in the world and, you know, something like Stuxnet. So here's the main threat again on this side, same World of Warcraft stuff. But now we're going to go up against a multi-processor box. Anybody got a box with multiple processors? That's just a little joke. Everybody does. Even your phone has multiple processors now. Right? So, you know, instead of using a DLL interpositioning thing, we're just going to stop the chip, one of the chips. We're going to throw interrupt 3 at an Intel chip. So we put in a hardware breakpoint, and that means this chip that was running the WoW thing stops. Now, when that happens, what else stops? All the security monitor stuff also stops. So it's like, whoop, that chip is stopped. And then with a hypervisor or a supervisor, it depends on how you're doing this thing, could be multi-threaded or multi-core, doesn't really matter. We take control, and we have, forget about the injected stuff. We just have some code over here that runs. And we can get access to the shared memory. We can build ourselves a nice little exploit, compute it all up, make it really small, and then shove it into the brain of that processor and turn it back on. So this processor just goes, whoo. And when it comes back to life, its little world is different. In fact, have you ever heard about reentrant code, you guys, in here? Yes? No? Who uses Java? Yeah? One person, she's not going, I'm not kidding. I saw you. Yeah. Java's a multi-threaded thing, right? So you have to write reentrant code. You have to worry about what happens if somebody swaps you out and gives some other thread precedence over you and the world changes. You really have to code to that. If you're taking operating systems class and they're teaching you about starvation and lockout and semaphores and critical sections, pay attention. Because that is going to be the future source of all sorts of attacks. We need to know about time and state, right? So what happens in this world is we stop a chip, and the chip comes back alive, and it does no Rip Van Winkle testing, right? It doesn't go, oh, I've been asleep for a million cycles. I wonder what happened. It just goes, oh, I'm on the next step. So if you code like, I do this step, then I get an if thing, and I one step at a time. That's not the way computers really work, guys. The way computers work is I do a step, the entire world changes. I do a step, the entire world changes. It's kind of interesting. You can actually see the impact of that problem on badly designed systems like Android. So you look at the Android coding paradigm, and you're looking at Android, and you're like, so let me get this straight. I do something, and then I put my own brain there so that when I take a step forward, I put my brain back on. It's like, why are you writing your brain down and putting it there and then putting it back on after each step? And you look at the code, it's like, what? Who made this crap up? And the reason for that is because the world changes between steps. You could get asynchronously interrupted at any time, and you need to be able to deal with that possibility. It's kind of interesting. So, this kind of attack still works fine against World of Warcraft. In fact, you know, anytime you can sort of make a hypodermic syringe and get a little bit of state injected somewhere, you have stuff that's mostly non-detectable from an attack perspective. And that's not the sort of thing that Stuxnet needed, but it's just, you know, compare those two things and then think about, uh-oh, we seem to be in trouble. Here's why we seem to be in trouble. There's a lot of vulnerabilities. If you add up the vulnerabilities of all the years that haven't been patched, and you just put the cumulative sum, you can see that the pile's really damn big. Even the recent pile, that's up through 2011. So we are making progress, but we're not making progress fast enough to stop vulnerability production. Here's a good, 2005 vulnerability production was going down. That's good, but the cumulative pile is still large. We live in a target-rich environment. And we're creating more targets all the time. And ironically, a lot of the target that we're creating, I just wrote about this last night, is security stuff. Like, we make security mechanisms for the cloud, which is all new software that's broken, and then we put those globs out there. That's another target. So ironically, all the security crap that we're putting is new target, and we're busy making it and buying it as fast as we can. We got to fix that. Now I want to talk about attack complexity. The thing that made Stuxnet kind of interesting in the code, besides the DLL interpositioning, which is not that interesting, the part that made it complicated was Stuxnet was supposed to hide itself. It wasn't attack code. We weren't trying to make Iran's centrifuges break. That wasn't the idea. In fact, they had, you know, making a centrifuge is pretty cheap. You got to, there's some couple special parts, but it's pretty cheap. And they had 2,000 of those in the closet. So if one shook itself to death, just get another one, put it in there. That's, we couldn't attack them all. The idea instead was just to make the engineers feel like nincompoops, like I was explaining before. And so what you want to do is have the attack run, but also be disguising that thing. Now, if you just wanted to disrupt a process in a random way, look, you can do that with a fuzzer, right? You just send packets and screw the thing up. And fuzzing will work for that. That's process disruption. If you want to attack a process in a principled way so that it breaks in a certain way and you know how it's going to break, you can anticipate what's going to happen, that's a whole different level of complexity. And then finally, at the very top of the pyramid, if you want to do that and you also want to disguise the fact that you're in the control system in the first place, that's another thing altogether. And when you're doing, what do you call it? I can't think of the word. When you're attacking a system and you're just trying to ruin it without, you know, making people know that you're actually attacking it. God, why get sabotage? There it is, bing. When you're sabotaging a system from an espionage perspective, you're way up at the top of the pyramid there. By the way, I stole this slide from Langner. The original URL for his stuff is right there. And I'll give you guys these slides so you can put them up. Here's another problem. This is an economics thing that I also stole from Ralph. Now, how many nuclear sub fleets are there out there in the world? Two? Maybe? Probably 2.5. I don't know if the Swedish one counts. Right? So that cost a lot of money to have a nuclear sub fleet. Like $90 billion. So it's not like you can just run out and make a nuclear sub fleet tomorrow. It takes some serious resources. How about stealth fighter jet fleets? Well, there are probably 5 of those. That's about a $40 billion proposition. You can't just run out and make a fighter jet program that's stealth fighter level cheaply. There's a few countries that can do that. Eurojet, that's about a $10 billion thing. Or, you know, the Leopard 2 tank fleet, which is awesome if you want to refight World War II for some reason. Right, so not sure why we need those. Okay, so, well, if you move on down the food chain, how about a cyber weapons program? Well, that's probably about $1 billion for something that goes after hardened military targets. Right, so this is not consumer-grade attacks. We're attacking actual military-grade attacks. Guess how many states, that is nations, have annual defense budgets in excess of $1 billion? Anybody know? Take a guess. 4? 12? Anybody want to guess? Come on. I'm going to stop. 5 is wrong. It's an order of magnitude more. 70. Isn't that amazing? 70 nations spend more than $1 billion. And that, if they stopped building Leopard tanks or whatever, that would, you know, arm an entire serious cyber war program. That's a lot of states. Now, how about if you just went after unhardened, you know, civilian targets like power plants and dams and control systems and stuff like that? That's about a $100 million proposition, right? In fact, there are, you know, 20 countries that can do the Eurojet thing, and there are 70 that can do the $1 billion thing, but it gets worse. Here's where it gets worse. This is where anybody can do it. If you wanted to just do a single attack to cause some sort of, you know, terrorism problem, that's about a $5 million proposition. And you can do that, like some rich guys can do that, individuals. And that is an issue. You see, so we need to work on cyber defense because it's cheap to do cyber offense. It's cheap. The economics say we have to work on defense or we're just dumb. We have this problem, though, that I call the NASCAR effect. It's cool to hack stuff. It's fun to talk about hacking stuff. It's fun to be a penetration tester. It's really fun to throw rocks, especially when you're youngins like you guys. You know, you're 18, 19, you're like, dude, look at those dumbass old guys, can't build a thing. It turns out that's the easy bit, guys. The hard part's building stuff right. Now, those of us over here in teacher land with the gray hair and stuff, our idea is maybe we can lure you into thinking about engineering properly by letting you throw some rocks for a while, and then we'll teach you how to do it right. That's what we're doing, right? Don't tell them. Right? So we're going to try to accidentally make you learn how to do systems engineering, but you got to understand, unfortunately, the notion of building things right is harder than the notion of breaking stuff with rocks. And in fact, it's way more interesting to talk about breaking stuff, which is why we have, you know, in the United States, we have this thing called NASCAR. It's kind of like Formula One for rednecks. And, you know, you drive around your car in a circle, and every once in a while, somebody crashes in a spectacular crash, which is why you're there in the first place drinking beer. You're like, woohoo, he died. And then you take the number and you stick it on your truck and you make a whole new saint and everything. And that's the way NASCAR works. I can say that because I'm from Tennessee where they invented it, right? So there are a lot of channels of NASCAR on television in the States. On satellite, there's probably, you know, 6 or 7 NASCAR channels. Guess how many Volvo car safety channels there are? Zero, right? So don't forget that when you're working on the fun stuff, we have to do the real work too. The fun stuff is way easier. Sure, we got to be able to know how systems break. I think it's fantastic to talk about exploits, to talk about real exploit code, to build viruses, to take down stuff, to really break stuff. We have to do that in order to understand how to build stuff better. So I'm not one of those people who thinks we should pretend that's not the case, or we shouldn't talk about that, or don't teach about that. On the contrary, we have to teach about that. But the reason that we teach about that is so that we know how to build stuff right. Who's taking mechanical engineering in here? Anybody? That's interesting. When you go to mechanical engineering, which is about stuff like bridges, you come into the very first class when you're like a new kid, and you're like, you know, scared to be in university. And the first thing they do is they show you the Tacoma Narrows Bridge shaking itself to death. It, like, they, you know, the guy designed it the wrong frequency and it hit its resonance frequency and it fell in the dam right in Puget Sound. And that was a problem for mechanical engineers. They still talk about it. And you know what they do on the first day of class? They go, "Don't let that happen to your bridge." And everybody's like, "Ooh." Now you go to computer land and they're like, "Today we're going to write Hello World." That's screwed up. We need to talk about the Arian 5 and the Therac 25 and Stuxnet and say, "Don't let that happen to your code." Right? We need to do that. That's a difference in the way we teach. Okay. Now let's talk about defense. What is the solution? Well, the first problem is, our paradigm in computer security is to put a perimeter. What? You say, I got an hour, right? Is that right? Oh, really? I thought I had an hour. I got 45 minutes? It's over? Fantastic. Okay, I'll hold it to 10 minutes, but we're going to go fast. Right, so this notion of a perimeter, sorry, that was my bad. I just assumed it was an hour. The notion of a perimeter defense requires a perimeter. If you think about this castle in 1350, the edge of military technology was, I'm going to strap metal to my body and so I can barely walk, and then I'm going to get on a horse with also metal on its body, and we're going to like we can go about 10 miles before everyone dies. We're going to go attack the neighbors. Go! And you get there to the neighbors, and you go, oh, damn, water. Right? All the way around the whole edge. That's a fantastic defense in 1350. Now, what if you want to attack it today? What do? You just paint it from space with a laser, and then you send in a predator drone. Right? Perimeter? I don't think so. There's no water on the top, right? So so the world has changed. And if you think about modern systems, there's no perimeter anymore. Cloud gets rid of the perimeter. Wireless mobile devices gets rid of the perimeter. Massively distributed systems get rid of the perimeter. There's no perimeter. And if you don't have a perimeter, you can't put a firewall. And if you don't have a firewall, you can't have all those people in operations watching it and going, hey, we're being attacked now. Turn it off. Right, so we have to do a different kind of engineering because the perimeter's gone away. And so what we're doing is we're kind of like putting up a fence and we're saying, look at that. That'll stop them. I think Bruce Schneier said it best. He said, you know, we build a fence like we put up one fence post and we really hope that the attacker comes running straight into it. Whoa, got him again. What do we have to do? Well, we have to do security engineering. We have to do software security. We have to build stuff right. I'm going to give you 4-minute overview on how to do that. There's this book. You should read this book. It's way better than Dowd's stupid book. And it's the updated version of that. That was written in 2001. That's a philosophy book, right? So this is the one from 2006. And my friend here said he would buy a copy of you for you if you want. So just talk to him down here for free. Thanks a lot. That's really cool. Yep. In that book, I talk about the notion of putting some best practices into the software development life cycles. Doesn't matter which one there is. If you have code, you should do code review with a tool. If you have an architecture document, you can do architecture risk analysis, and so on. That's the basis of software security. Lately, we have a science experiment that I was telling some people about this morning called the BSIM. The BSIM studies 67 different companies, including all of these, and how they do software security as an institution. It's not about securing a piece of software. It's about teaching 30,000 developers that are a bank. Really, banks have 20,000 developers now. The ones in Bergen have 30, but, you know, that's a lot. They're still writing code. It turns out that banks are software houses now. Those guys all need to learn about software security and how to do it right. They need to be trained. They need to have the right tools. The architects need to know the architecture stuff. That is what the BSIM describes and measures from all of these firms up here. I don't have time to tell you about the guts of the BSIM. We're going to skip that part. But I want you to go to BSIM.com, that's BSIMM.com, and download this thing and read it. It's only 70 pages. But it has 112 paragraphs that describe actual activities that software security professionals do all day. Real ones, not theory. It's what's done by those 67 firms. That's a very powerful thing. And the question is that what I'm learning in school? Or is there a discrepancy? Am I learning to learn how to do that? I mean, these are things that you need to think about. If you're interested in software security as a career, which I think you should all do, because by God, we have a big software security problem. If you want to get paid vast quantities of money in the future, become a software security person. In fact, if you want to be overpaid next year, I'll overpay you to do that. Seriously, way overpay you. So in the BSIM project, we've got it up to 67 firms. We're controlling the work of about 250,000 developers, 272,358 developers in those firms. And we're changing the way they work, those developers. That seems like a lot of people, 250,000. It's the population of Bergen, right? But 250,000 is probably, what did we say, 1/29th of the actual population of developers. There are probably 8 million developers on planet Earth. So we have our work cut out for us. And, you know, we have plenty of work to do to get that done. 2 more minutes. I know, I'm sorry. They didn't tell me. We blame them. Yes. What's that say? It's a piece of paper? I don't have that. Right, so here's a real problem. This building security and stuff, the government's not participating in this. And in fact, the government in the United States is a good 5 years behind in terms of software security. We were talking this morning, European firms that are doing the BSIM show by data that we're about 18 months to 2 years behind in Europe of what's going on in the United States with software security. We know what to do. Now we just have to do it. All developers need to do this stuff. All right. Now, I have some other deterrent stuff for policymakers that I'm not going to talk about here. But you can get these slides and read this stuff later. It turns out that there are all sorts of policy reasons for focusing on security engineering, for building stuff right, that include deterrence and that include, you know, things like the fact that we, as the first world, collectively can outspend our adversaries on building stuff properly, and we can all be more secure as a result. Instead of outspending on weapon systems, we outspend on cyber defense. And that'll make everybody safer, and we can outspend the people that we think are our enemies now. So that's kind of an interesting thing. One last thing in the last 1 minute. Some pointers for you. I write a column for Search Security. I was writing one last night. Yaron read it before I even sent it in. And that talks about practical aspects of software security in a trade rag sort of a sense. You can get those at Search Security. There's this podcast that was mentioned. It's called Silver Bullet. Listen to that. It's fun. It has about 10,000 listeners every month. And it's me interviewing other security people. Mostly they're my friends. And so we have a funny dance of mutually assured destruction during our conversation, right? There's this book, free copies down here. We already talked about that. And there's my email address. I care about software security. If you care about software security and you think it's something cool and you want to learn about it, feel free to send me email and I will answer you, because we need to create more software security people on planet Earth so we can avoid this cyber war disaster. And we need to get our policymakers and our politicians and the people that are driving the car incorrectly to do a better job thinking about getting us out of the glass house that we're in. That's all. Thanks. I guess we have time for zero questions. Yep. I did that. That's why it doesn't look bad. Can you unplug it? Just unplug it. Unplug it. Let's put on some music real quick. Hang on a second.